This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Hello, and welcome to Verge ESP, a podcast about art and science on The Verge. My name is Emily Yoshida. I am the entertainment editor at The Verge.
I'm Liz Lopato. I'm the science editor at The Verge. This here is Wilderness Week on The Verge. If you haven't been paying attention, you should definitely go check it out. As you may know, the National Park System is turning 100, and so we've decided to celebrate by thinking about wilderness in all of its forms. So I went out to L.A. And taunted Emily with baby lizards.
They're you guys.
you should go see the baby photos. They are, like, really teeny. Like, they are itsy-bitsy. But that's not all we've got. You know, we've also got a feature up right now about ant eradication on the Santa Cruz Islands. First, they killed the cows because the cows were big. And then they killed the goats.
And then they came to the ants because they said nothing.
as ants do. But so, you know, there's a bunch of other stuff in there that's pretty neat as well. We've put up some of our gear. We actually brought our gear into the office. Those of us at Verge West who do a fair amount of hiking and camping brought our gear in and talked about it a little bit on the site. If you do read that, you'll notice that everybody in the comments is really mad about the headline because we didn't road test gear to call it the best gear. We were just like, this is the gear we use, so it's the best. sorry about that, guys. I didn't write the headline.
But I want to know what stuff to buy. I need to know where to spend my money. Yeah.
Well, I explicitly wrote about a pack that I had bought for $50 used on Craigslist, and I didn't even know what the model was.
Yeah.
And someone very helpfully in the comments was like, oh, it's a 2004 or whatever. But the point was, for me at least, that, like, the best gear is the gear that gets you outside. So buy the gear that gets you outside. Like, if it's something that's ultralight, then buy ultralight gear. If it's like you sit on Craigslist and you peruse backpack listings until you find stuff that looks good, hey, like, that's another way to go. You don't have to, like, spend a ton of money and you don't have to buy new shit in order to go outside. And if that is the only thing that you take away from Wilderness Week, I will be happy.
Yeah.
But we've got a bunch of other stuff. We have some stuff about bat lickers.
Okay.
Which is what it sounds like. People who lick bats. Don't lick the bats. And one of my personal favorites is a Facebook group that calls out fake nature photography.
Oh, wow.
It's just called,
like, Truths Photos?
Truths Behind Fake Nature Photography.
That's the name of the site?
Of the Facebook group, yeah.
Okay.
And so they call out fakes when they see them. Their tagline is, say no to staged photos with bullshit stories. And so they post viral photographs, which are weirdly often sourced from the Daily Mail, and then list the giveaways that something is fake. And so we have one of those photos up on the site. It's a frog riding a beetle, but it's unreliable for a couple of reasons. The frog is nocturnal. Its fingers are on an unusual and manipulated position. And the person who took the photo themselves has several pet frogs.
Okay.
So they're like the fact checkers for nature photographs. So, like, the cute animal photo that you see online, like, if you want to know what's true, go talk to these people because they will tell you.
So it's sort of the flip side of what we were talking about with nature documentaries last time. Just these in this case, these are fakeries that don't necessarily relate an ecstatic truth about frogs riding on beetles.
Right. It's like, it's not just about, like, a shopped photo, although they'll identify those too. It's subjects that are in staged settings or unnatural environments. And so, you know, there are certain things that you can tell if you are a hardcore nature enthusiast that things are not quite right. So they try to contact photographers, but they don't necessarily receive a lot of responses.
I would definitely encourage everybody to check out Wilderness Week. It'll be wrapping up by the time you hear this, but that doesn't mean that the content goes away, because content is forever.
That's true.
So be sure to check that out on theverge.com. Hey, you want to hear a good joke? Nobody speak, nobody get choked.
So I don't know how many of you folks out there have kids, but I feel like parents are probably a little bit more alert to this following story than most people, and it's about EpiPens.
So if you are extremely allergic to something, often what's used to stop anaphylactic shock, which can lead to death, is epinephrine, which is a medicine that's basically been around forever. But there's the EpiPen, which was $47 in 2007. It is now $284 this summer, and you can't buy a single pen anymore. So the retail price to fill a prescription today is about $600.
Are these covered by insurance at all?
It depends on your insurance plan. Right. I mean, like, for some people, probably yes. But, like, the thing is, nothing has really changed.
Right. It's
and
just
it costs
a,
less than a dollar.
It's a steroid, right?
It's epinephrine, which it's basically like a version of adrenaline.
Oh, right. Okay. Yes.
So essentially, like, what's interesting here is that the EpiPen is packaged the way it is because it gives you like a foolproof dose and potentially is safer than just having a syringe with adrenaline.
That seems like a bad idea.
Right. The problem is that, you know, with a lot of prescription drugs, companies get exclusivity, and that means that they have no competition and they can raise their prices however they want. The exclusivity periods kind of vary. I think they're 5 to 7 years for small molecules, like pills, basically, and 12 years for biologics, which are things like AbbVie's Humira, which is for rheumatoid arthritis.
And which of these is the EpiPen?
The EpiPen is...
Because they've been around for a while, right? These aren't terribly new. I mean...
No, they're not. But so people with, like, life-threatening allergies, you know, they keep these things around in case you run into, like, for instance, a peanut if you're allergic to peanuts, or a bee if you're stung by a bee, you know? And they have short shelf lives, right? So you have to buy a couple a year. It's you know, even if you haven't used it this year, you still have to buy a new one next year because otherwise it doesn't really move. And so people are getting really fed up by how much this costs. And Mylan is saying, oh, yes, well, we have $100 coupons. But the thing that I want to make sure that we're all super clear on is that what Mylan is doing is absolutely normal.
Right.
Okay?
This isn't unusual. It's just that it happens to be a more pedestrian medication need that, like, a comparatively large part of the population does need and buy EpiPens. Compared to, like, something for some very, very rare deadly disease.
I mean, these stories started to come up basically when people started stocking up for the school year. And, like, they had to buy new EpiPens, and oh my God, they were so expensive. And so I want us to cast our minds back to last year when we were talking about pharma bro Martin Shkreli, who raised the price of an anti-parasite drug called Dataprim more than 50-fold to $750 a pill. And he was, you know, he was questioned about this, and he was like, oh, I'm, you know, this is normal. And the thing is, he's right. So I have in front of me a Bloomberg story from February where they tracked about 3,000 brand name prescription drugs and found that prices doubled for 60 and at least quadrupled for 20 since December 2014. One of the biggest increases was a different Mylan drug called Alcortin A, which is a combination of a steroid and antibiotic gel that's sold to treat eczema and skin infections. That went up 20-fold. So this is something that is super normal and super common in the drug industry. And one of the things that happens a lot that I remember from my old days as a drug reporter is that as a drug starts to get closer to losing exclusivity, basically pharma companies wring all the money out of it they can. They start doing more price increases. So I would like to know when we are going to stop talking about specific drugs and specific price increases and talk about socialized medicine. Because one of the things that we know for a fact is that this was published in JAMA this week. Americans pay more for drugs than just about anybody else in the world, but we aren't any healthier.
Right, yeah.
I want you all to let that sink in. Part of that is that, you know, Medicare and Medicaid pay for a lot of drugs, and they are federally barred from negotiating. That was passed, I think, in 2003, so that's a George W. Bush legacy. Enjoy that. And part of it, too, is just that, and this is my own personal hot take, capitalism works well in well-regulated markets where demand is not infinite, but, like, you'll pay anything so that your kid will live.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. Let's put whatever price on this and let the market determine what the price should be. It's like there's no cap on what the price should be.
That's right. And I mean, like, this sort of idea of having these extremely pricey treatments was really sort of in the modern era pioneered by a company called Genzyme that was bought by Sanofi Aventis. And they made drugs for very rare diseases.
and sold them for thousands and thousands of dollars. And the difference, it was the difference between life and death for a lot of people. And their reason for that pricing was that they had done all this expensive research, they had to recoup their costs somehow, and there weren't going to be very many patients, and so they were charging thousands and thousands of dollars. But that seems to be something that a lot of drug makers have adopted. And, you know, I saw a couple of very naive columns saying, oh, well, the problem is insurance, because consumers, you know, they don't really know how much this stuff costs.
Right.
That's cute. A lot of us don't have insurance.
Right.
So that's not actually the problem.
But yes, but even if you're talking about people with insurance, all that means when you have these enormous sums of money being traded between an insurance company and a pharmaceutical company, like what you're saying, it doesn't make anybody any healthier. It just increases the amount of money being exchanged. Like, if at the end of the day, you're going to get the treatment no matter what, and it's covered by your insurance company, it doesn't make any difference to you. All it does is increase the amount of, like, this abstract money moving between two large bodies. So, like, if that's what you're really in favor of, if that's, like, the thing that you're passionate about and that should continue to exist, then, like, cool. I can't get terribly excited about, like, let's increase the amount of money being exchanged.
And the thing is, it's not just limited to specialty companies or small companies either. Like, big companies like Pfizer and Glaxo keep pushing through price increases as well, usually around the start of the year. So, you know, it's been remarkable.
So the EpiPen, how is it about to go generic? Like, is it running up against that that deadline, like the other medications?
You betcha. That's exactly what's going on. So in 2012, Mylan, which is the company behind EpiPen, settled a lawsuit by agreeing to allow a generic competitor into the market last year. Okay. And so they'd already been steadily raising the price of EpiPen. Like, this is not like, you know, it was $29 or something, and now it's $600, you know. It didn't go from that to the other in, you know, a day. Mm-hmm. But this is a really common thing. So it's like a final attempt to get as much money as possible out of this drug. But yeah, so basically before the generics come to market, they just try to squeeze like every single drop of blood out of that stone. And so, you know, it used to be like a 10% price increase, and now it's a lot more.
Right.
The thing is, like, the expected generic is from Teva, but it was unexpectedly rejected by FDA. And there was a non-generic alternative from Sanofi, but it got pulled from the market last year because there were dosing problems. So Mylan basically has a monopoly for at least another year. And so it's one of those things where it's just like, there's not a lot you can do. Do you want your kid to die from anaphylaxis or not?
Right. Well, this does feel like another side of what we were talking about when we were talking about Theranos, which is the idea of conflating science and business. And in a way, like, I feel like maybe people were a little more engendered to understand the way that Theranos was taking a kind of startup approach to science and health, because we do kind of have a corporate approach to how we treat people in the medical system. Like, it's not like it's a foreign idea that's entering the way that we do health in the United States.
No. I mean, like, again, this is the system. This is the system we have set up, and it's how it works here. We don't have to have this system. There are other places where there's single payer, and that's cheaper, and people tend to be healthier. We could, if we wanted to, decide that because drugs are medically necessary, we won't accept patents on them anymore. And that would change things quite a lot. But the thing that's really ironic to me, a lot, you know, the drug companies will tell you, oh, you know, we charge so much for our prescription drugs because it's so difficult to develop drugs. And they're right. A lot of drugs fail in development, and they're very expensive to bring to market. Like, the figures vary. The really high end, which I would not trust, is $2 billion. The really low end is something like $500 million. Either way, it's pretty expensive.
Yeah.
But the thing that they don't mention is that a lot of these drugs actually were developed out of academia and licensed. And so places like MIT have licensing offices, patent licensing offices, for selling the technology that they have developed to companies, some of which are, you know, formed around the technology itself, some of which just license. Like, so for instance, you know, a company like Pfizer could potentially come to MIT after seeing something really cool in Nature and be like, oh yes, we want to develop this novel antibiotic. That is a joke for those of you who are not familiar with science, because nobody ever wants to develop novel antibiotics because they don't sell. Because what happens is that doctors hold them back so that there won't be as much resistance. So there is no financial incentive to develop these life-saving drugs without which we cannot perform surgery and without which many of us would die. So FYI, that's why we have no antibiotics, is because we have decided that medicine needs capitalism. Just so you know.
Well, I mean, but name one thing that capitalism hasn't helped, you know, inordinately.
So, you know, we're a
Bernie Bros podcast now, so.
but I mean, like, if you go back to people like Jonas Salk, you know, we don't have polio anymore in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Like, we straight up don't have it. And the only reason that was patented was to prevent somebody else from patenting it and selling it. And that was, like, viewed as a public good. It was the kind of thing that, like, that basically made a saint out of Salk. It's worth contemplating, you know, the other incentives that exist for people to continue to develop drugs and become doctors and so on. Like, for instance, prestige. And, I don't know, the general willingness to do good in the world. Because...
Yeah.
Because those things, I think, are probably going to be more powerful in terms of actually benefiting human health than money. Because, you know, right now the calculation is we don't need antibiotics because they don't sell, but we do need to develop, you know, drugs for feminine sexual dysfunction. And, like, I'm not saying that feminine sexual dysfunction isn't a problem. I'm just saying that antibiotics are a much more pressing problem.
Right. Well, how much of this money, like these gobs and gobs of money, I mean, is it all going to researchers? Is it all going to these patents? Or how much of it is just going to, like, the top of these companies?
That's what's really interesting, because pharmaceutical executives have never been paid so well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's where part of it's going. Some of it's going to shareholders, and some of it is going to R&D for sure, but not as much as it used to. So it seems like a lot of it is just ending up in the pockets of individual pharma CEOs who are getting very rich on you being sick. And the thing that I think is grossest about it, when you talk to people who don't believe in vaccination, they'll tell you that pharmaceuticals are a conspiracy meant to extract money from people. And the way that the system is set up, it's very hard to argue against them because,
right.
I mean, vaccines work. But the thing is, like, the way that we have handled drug pricing means that, you know, medicine is a for-profit institution. And so, like, for instance, drug companies will pay doctors in order to, quote-unquote, educate them about their products. Like, they'll take them out to lunch, or they'll take them out to resorts.
Right.
Or they'll hire them as speakers. And then those doctors seem to prescribe a lot more of the medications for the company that's paying them,
right,
even though, like, it's not a straight pay-for-play kind of thing. And this is the sort of thing that really destroys trust in the physician relationship and in American medicine, full stop. Like, this is a lot more pernicious than just, like, somebody, like, using your illness as a way of, like, squeezing money out of you. It really, like...
It goes all the way
destroys,
to the top.
Yeah.
And into every single interaction.
Trust.
Yeah.
It destroys trust in every single interaction, even when we know the drugs work really well and are, in fact, life-saving. So, you know, something to think about.
Well, we can read more about this on The Verge, right? You've done a couple of reports on this now.
We've done a couple of reports on drug prices, and I am queuing up one of my slow takes. So something will
Yay,
show up in a week or two.
Yay, slow takes.
Right. If I could see the see you faking. If you could see my thoughts, you would see your faces. Safe in my rental. Like,
well, speaking of giant companies destroying our trust in every interaction and transaction.
Go on.
Frank Ocean released not one album, but two albums this last weekend. A very, very highly anticipated album. It had been 4 years since Channel Orange came out, which was a pretty much universally acclaimed his first proper album. He had released a series of mixtapes before then, and that was in 2012. I was a big fan of that record, for what it's worth. So, you know, I have a hard time getting in on this, like, where's the album kind of, like, frenzy around things. I'm pretty, like... I don't know. It's, and again, one of these things that makes me feel old, because I'm just like, hey, guys, it's going to happen when it happens. I got so many other things to pay attention to and catch up with right now that, like, Frank can drop his album whenever he wants. But it turns out he dropped two albums. One was Endless, which was it's basically a video album, but not as much of a huge production as Beyoncé's Lemonade, which was out earlier this year. This is just more one kind of continuous scene that goes for the length of the album. And that was on Apple Music as a video. And then later that weekend, he released Blonde, which is like the most hotly debated album of the year, at least in terms of spelling. Nobody knows how to spell blonde.
Well, it's a problem of gender, is it not?
Yes, it is. Also, if you want the official explanation, not official, but at least like what's now the official explanation, that it is blonde, B-L-O-N-D-E, but it is stylized as blonde with no E.
I assumed there was no E because he's on the cover and B-L-O-N-D is a male
blonde. It's the male blonde, yeah. It is ambiguous, like much of the album. I'm sure that this is fully intentional. I mean, it's basically like they'll say stylized as blank anytime like somebody spells their name weird or capitalizes it weird or like Bastille spells it with a triangle instead of an A. that's a stylization. So this is, you know, I mean, Frank Ocean's just like Bastille. That's the end of my take. No. But so, you know, we got much more than we were expecting. We got a magazine if you were living in New York and could hike out to his little pop-up store, which I did not. Even though I was in New York, I was having a very couch-bound weekend. But we can talk about the album itself and the music a little bit. I'm still kind of figuring out how I feel about a lot of it. But I think what's happened with how it's been released by Apple is kind of what I'm really interested in right now. This was an Apple exclusive. More and more artists are doing this, especially kind of the big artists that have large internet followings, I would say. It's not just like top line artists. It's big internet artists that tend to get these. Like Chance the Rapper had an exclusive on Apple. Drake obviously did. And then, you know, there are also the Tidal artists. So, you know, Beyonce having her album on Tidal for, I think, a week or something. Some, like, miserably small amount that you know that she just, like, railroaded Jay-Z for. So we are just, like, getting into this era where these streaming services are essentially functioning as the albums. The streaming services have artists. I mean, there's, like, an 80% overlap in most of the material that's on any given streaming service. And there are, like, three major ones or four major ones right now. But the big headliner artists, a lot of those are exclusives. And this was sort of underlined this week when it came out that Endless, the video album that's on Apple Music, that had been the fulfillment of Frank Ocean's contract with Universal Music Group and Def Jam. I guess he was just contracted to do, like, two albums, or maybe he just had one and, like, it was a fight. I have no idea what the terms of the contract were, because usually people do contracts for many albums. But so that was the end of his contract. And then Blonde, which was formerly going to be called Boys Don't Cry, which came out after, was officially outside of his contract. That was an independent release. There's also, it's also been reported, like, that the recording for Boys Don't Cry / Blonde was funded by Universal. It cost, like, you know, several million to produce. And after the release of the album, which was released exclusively on Apple also, Apple paid the recording costs back to Universal so that they didn't owe them anything. So this is like this all sounds very businessy and like top level and kind of abstract, maybe, if you don't pay attention to this stuff.
I don't know. I think pretty much anybody gets excited about screwing the record companies after the CD wars of the 90s.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and this would be the second time that Apple has just like punched the recording industry in the face, because iTunes, of course, was like the beginning of the end. Or like the first kind of institutionalized blow, because obviously there was file sharing before that. But then Apple's like, hey, look, everybody's doing this. Let's make money off this instead of CDs. And let's make people come to us and associate us with the people who give them music, as opposed to physical record stores and record labels. So this is just like making that the full realization of that with this. And as a result, Universal Music, which is the largest record conglomerate or record group in the industry, they have put a total ban on exclusives for streaming services, which is pretty wild.
I imagine they were going to do it anyway, and this provided them with a pretty nice excuse. Because, yeah. The thing is, they've had a couple of streaming things this year, right? They had Life of Pablo, mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah. Which is also another weird situation. Yeah.
Right. With those guys, they at least had, the number one to, soothe the fact that they weren't getting as much revenue. But, mm-hmm. Because Frank Ocean did this the way he did, Endless isn't even going to be a number one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're not even selling. I don't think you can buy Endless. You can't buy a download of Endless. And I don't think that you can stream it just as music. I think it only exists as the video on Apple. That might have changed. But I know that's how it was over the weekend. And I don't know that there were any plans to add just the regular tracks, the way that Beyonce, you can just listen to Lemonade as tracks. You don't have to listen to the or watch the video. So this is pretty wild. It's also, so in effect, then Apple is now Frank's label because Apple released the music. It paid it retroactively for the recording costs. And it promoted it and very well, I would add. It's the top thing anytime you go onto the Apple store, and everybody knew this was going to happen. I mean, everybody knew that this album was coming in. I don't know what the download numbers or stream numbers are on it. I mean, let's be real, nobody cares about the download numbers now, but I don't know what the stream numbers are, but it'll be interesting to see. I think the numbers will come out for this because it was a weekend release. I think we might not get them till next week, but this is sort of the first that we've seen somebody make that jump. I mean, people have brought up Chance because he's an independent artist. He doesn't have a label, so he just released through Apple. But that feels different than an artist that was with Universal Music Group ditching basically the week of release and saying, yeah, Apple's my label now.
Yeah, I mean, this was a very hardcore undercutting of Universal by Apple. They could have spaced that release out, and instead they did it, 2 days later? A day later?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think, from what I understand, is it was a very stressful week. Everybody was trying to really make sure he got the music out. There was, a big fear that he was going to push again. Because all this pushing, from all reports that I have heard, was on his end. He wanted to continue tinkering and perfect the album. And finally, Apple had to push him and say, no, we need to have this out. So I have many questions about this. I want to know how good of a label Apple's going to be, if that's a business it wants to get into. It feels a little, I don't know if this is right, but is this an antitrust type situation or no vertical integration or something? Just the fact that, I mean, it's the old studio systems where you had the studios would make the films, they owned the stars, they'd put out a movie, and that movie would only show in theaters owned by that studio. This was back in the 30s before that kind of got knocked down. But I kind of wonder how good it's actually going to be for music. I mean, on the flip side now, because you have Universal getting out of this exclusive games, but they're not the entire industry. So it's going to incentivize more artists, I think, on other labels, especially artists who have been having notoriously hard times with their labels. Drake is one I can think of who has a very cozy relationship with Apple already. But a lot of people will then say, okay, now I'm going to be represented by Spotify. Spotify is going to be my label. So then you're going to have that situation where it makes it even more clear that everybody's just going to have subscriptions to five different streaming services if they want to have access to every single, A-list artist.
It's going to be like cable. It's going to be
Yeah. And I mean, it is going to be like cable. That's the thing, is that it's so, if you zoom out and you look at how this is all, and this is the same with TV right now, when you look at how this is all kind of shaking out, I think Netflix and other streaming services are another good example of this. We're just building cable television again. That's the only place it's going. I think I talked about this like a year ago on Chris Plant's podcast, What's Tech, when I was talking about TV. But I want us to just fast forward to that, because that's obviously where we're going. Like, it's just going to be radio again, and you're going to have like four different channels. And like, they're all on demand channels.
You have to pay for them all now.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing.
You pay one bill.
For all of them.
You pay one bill, and you get Spotify, Apple Music, Google Play Music, and Amazon. And then Tidal won't be around anymore. I still have Tidal, but it's apparently going away.
Is it? I didn't know.
It got bought by Apple.
Oh, shit. I guess I'm going to be an Apple Music user now. I didn't know. Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe I should cancel my subscription. I bought it for Lemonade, as you may recall, and have
well,
been happy,
I got
happy
it
with
because
it since.
They have, that's the only streaming service that has a Prince's catalog on it.
Yeah.
But then I was like, I do have half of Prince's albums, like, as downloads on Amazon that I bought ages ago. I can just re-download those and, like, pay for the rest of his albums and then have them all available to me and, like, not have to pay that monthly fee for Tidal. So that's probably what I'm going to do.
I wonder if we're going to see a move back to physical music, because, I mean, like, one of the things that, like, I have Prince's albums, mm-hmm. like, records. And so while everybody was complaining about how hard it was to find Prince's music streaming, I was playing my records.
Right, yeah.
Like, you know, I have the streaming services on my phone for when I travel. Like, that's literally what they're for. Like, if I'm on transit or, like,
yeah.
I'm someplace that's not home, like, that's why I have them. Because I have physical objects.
Yeah, and I think the problem is that that's the majority of when so many people listen to music. If you don't have your lifestyle does not have you at your house a lot, then having a big record collection only goes so far, and people want to listen to music in all those different places. It makes me a little concerned. It makes me also feel like I should just get back into older musicians that I like and not worry so much about needing to, like, listen to whatever new release by a big artist the week it comes out, except for the fact that it's a part of my job, so I have to. But... Now I'm paying for four streaming services, so that's my life. That's the life I am living right now. I think in total, between all the streaming services I'm paying for, I think it comes to like $100 a month for everything.
Wow, that's a lot.
It's my job. So we'll be back in a second to talk about some more content. So it was a big content weekend for Emily Yoshida this last weekend.
Tell me more.
So in addition to Blonde and Endless coming out, I had the chance, I'm in the privileged position of getting to see the first five episodes of season three of Halt and Catch Fire. The first two, I guess, aired. They did a surprise airing of the first one on Sunday night, and then they showed that one and the second one on Tuesday night. So I'm not really sure. Like, this double episode thing is happening a lot. Mr. Robot is doing it as well. But I have talked about the show. We had Chris Rogers and Cantwell, on the podcast. I think it was our first podcast.
I think that's right.
ESP.
Yeah.
And I just continue to love the show. That's my take on it. It's become, I think it's really just improved exponentially each year. And this year, you know, our crew has all decamped to your homeland or your turf. They're all in Silicon Valley or in San Francisco, I guess. I guess it's a little bit
First of all, San Francisco is not Silicon Valley.
I know.
Second of all.
Well, it was, yeah, I guess they're in San Francisco. It's kind of funny. There's they've kind of done it cleverly. The office that Mutiny has taken over, Mutiny is the games turned chat community turned spoiler alert marketplace that Cameron and Donna start in season two. Their office in San Francisco is like an old detective office, it looks like. Like, it's got those high ceilings and the kind of partitioned off offices with the glass or the frosted glass doors. It was just like very noir-y, which is like total San Francisco to me. It makes me think of like Vertigo or something like that. So it's kind of cool. It also is like, it is straight out of Blade Runner as well, which is great because Blade Runner like came out concurrently with when the show is set. So I just like geek on these little details. But yeah, I mean, mostly the thing that always kind of catches my breath when I'm watching Halt and Catch Fire, catches my breath, is the relationship between the two female characters. I think we, you know, we tend to whine a little bit on the show about how different female characters are treated in TV shows and in movies. And it's such a wonderful example of how to do it right that, like, it makes me feel really protective and, like, almost emotional about just the existence of Donna and Cameron on this show, because they're two women who are very different and have decided to start a business together. And their relationship is as co-workers who clash not because they're fighting over a man or having like irrational emotions, but because they're working really hard and they're stressed out and they have different approaches to things. It's like purely about process as experienced by two characters who happen to be women. And it's so exciting to watch. It feels so unusual. But also just like normal. I think it's interesting. I know, you know, a lot of people who've watched the show, obviously, like, I tend to talk to men about this show because that's just how it works, I guess. I know a lot of, like, male TV writers and culture critics and stuff. And their reaction to her, to Cameron's character, who's played by Mackenzie Davis, is, oh, that's such an interesting character. That's such a strange character. And
what is interesting or strange about her? I have not watched this show.
Well, she's you know, the words that get used to describe Cameron the most in reviews of Halt and Catch Fire are androgynous, antisocial punk girl. And she's a programmer. She's supposed to be a genius programmer. In the first season, she's got like this really close cut kind of, I feel like it's a haircut that like Daryl Hannah had at one point or something. Like, she's got like this sort of boyish cut, wears a lot of like vintage t-shirts and stuff, has like a very blunt manner. And I think her character has softened somewhat over the past couple years, but I mean, that's still her defining characteristic is still that she's like bad with people and doesn't have a very good bedside manner as a manager. But when I watch her character, especially in the season, I'm like, that's just like, this character actually just feels like people that I know. Like, especially internet people who don't have very good social skills with people. I mean, it does feel, and obviously she's a person who's working in tech, like, you know, she's gravitated towards this for a reason. But like, I still feel like her reactions to things feel very normal, like, and contemporary. And I think it's interesting that, you know, even though I love my friends who are culture commentators who are men, like, that they think that that's unusual. I don't know.
Well, this kind of brings me back to something I did see, which was Ghostbusters.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw a lot of people talking about whether the Kate McKinnon character was real or, like, some kind of joke. And, like, to me, that was, like, the character that is, like, closest to my own self that I have ever seen on television or film, like, you know, like, right down to, holy shit, we're going to have some explosions, guys.
Yeah.
it's going to be cool, you know, and listening to people talk about whether, you know, like, there were real women like that, I realize, like, people don't realize that we're out here because we don't get written as mad scientists. The mad scientist is always a guy. And so, like, so too is the antisocial programmer, now that I'm thinking of it. Like,
yeah.
That is another role that is almost always male. And, like, I definitely know those women.
Yeah, of course. I mean, they make, like, your internet work. And they do, yeah. Like, they're all there. It's just, there's still a kind of, I think, rigid expectation about, or like, okay, sure, you can have this rebellious punk girl programmer, but like, she's gonna act like a person that's never existed on the face of the earth. Like, she's gonna be like a collection of cliches.
And the girl with the dragon tattoo, right. Are you thinking of her?
Yeah, like she'll be a symbol of something instead of a person. And it's just so not how they've handled this character. And I just like continue to be surprised and really appreciative of it. And I wasn't even the biggest fan of the character personally in the first season, but like I've come to really, really, really love her. And and I'm excited to see what happens. There's a really, I've watched five episodes and I'm not, you know, purposefully not doing spoilers, but there's also just like a lot of really interesting stuff about these characters, kind of the very subtle culture differences between, not so subtle, but like the culture differences on the West Coast and with San Francisco people and stuff. And sort of like it nods to a bunch of cliches that we know about, but doesn't say them out loud in a way that I think is like written very well. Yeah, I want people to watch this show. I think it's really special, and I think it's gotten so much better with every year.
This actually kind of brings to mind a book that I like a lot called Close to the Machine.
Mm-hmm.
And it is by a kind of androgynous punk girl.
Uh-huh.
Who was a programmer during the internet boom and bust in the 90s. Her name is Ellen Ullman. The book was published in 1997.
Uh-huh.
If you want to know what those punk girls are like, Close to the Machine is written by one, and it's about that experience, and it's a memoir, and it's incredible.
Man, I'll have to check that out. I'm like, I'm about to do a tear, I think, of like, she is that in Silicon Valley or in the Bay Area or something?
San Francisco proper, yeah.
Yeah.
She's like, I think she's running her own computer consulting business.
Okay.
And like lives where she works.
Yeah, yeah. That's like,
she's written another book called By Blood that's fiction that was like really, really highly acclaimed and came out like a year or two ago. But this Close to the Machine to me is a better book.
Well, yeah, I think I'm about to have like a multi Bay Area set book spree because I just got the Jeffrey Toobin's book about Patty Hearst.
Oh, yeah.
which I am going to eat up on vacation. It's going to be, I'm really excited to be, it's like.
Please mail me your copy when you're done.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, it's a, for people who don't know, it's a guy who did the book that the American Crime Story was based off of, the People versus OJ was based off of. So it's going to be a very exhaustive portrait of a crime, which I'm usually not like a true crime fan, but I've always been fascinated by this case, so I'm excited about it.
Well, yeah, I mean, for those of you who don't know, I don't know who these people would be, but let's imagine they're out there.
Teens!
Patty, teens, if you are under the age of, I don't know, 30 and have never heard about this, Patty Hearst is an heiress who very briefly was also a terrorist.
Yeah, and she claimed she got brainwashed by a terrorist group in Berkeley in 1973, I think. I was asking my mom, because my mom lived in Berkeley like right after that. I was like, were you there when it happened? Like, was it crazy? And she came right after the whole, you know, it all kind of died down, but still.
It's also the origin, if you are, for instance, a Zevon fan, of the final line of Roland the Headless Thompson Gunner.
Uh-huh.
Patty Hearst heard the burst of Roland's Thompson gun and bought it.
Nice. We'll have to do a whole Patty Hearst themed episode. I'm looking forward to it. Also, fun fact, her daughter just married Chris Hardwick. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that on here. I think it's public knowledge.
You know, I love fiction. I really do. But I have never read a single work of fiction that's as weird as The Real World.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. Why we do what we do. Well, I think that about does it for us this week. But please, if you have not yet, subscribe to VergeASP on iTunes and give us a wonderful rating. Just like break out your best $5 words when describing our podcast. And you can also find us on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/VergeESP. Also on Spotify if you're on mobile. And you can write to us on Twitter. Write to us. Send us a nice letter on Twitter. I am at Emily Yoshida, and Liz is at Miss Lopato, M.S. Lopato. And that does it for us.
All right, take care, folks.